On the night before his death, Jesus prayed what's now become known as his high priestly prayer. As he prayed the will of the Father for his disciples in all times and all places, he said, "I do not ask that you take them out of the world, but that you keep them from the evil one. They are not of the world, just as I am not of the world. Sanctify them in the truth. Your word is truth." For the follower of Jesus, our place is to be in, but not of the world. In today's world, one place where our countercultural presence has been compromised is in the area of sex and marriage. We increasingly and willingly choose beliefs and behaviors that go with the flow of the culture. What do young evangelical Christians believe about sex and marriage? And how can we guide them into God's good and beautiful plan for their sexuality? Stick with us as we talk to Dr. David Ayers about his new book, Sex and the Single Evangelical, on this episode of Youth Culture Matters.
From the Center for Parent Youth Understanding, this is Youth Culture Matters. If you're a parent, youth worker, educator, counselor, grandparent, or anyone else who cares about kids, we're glad you've joined us for this practical, informative, and hope-filled podcast. This is a place where together we talk and think Christianly about the rapidly changing world of today's children, teens, and young adults.
Well, welcome everybody to another episode of Youth Culture Matters. I'm Walt Mueller here at CPYU, and as always, it's great to have you join us. I want to remind you, those of you who have been listening, and especially those of you who have been listening for a long time to this podcast, that we would really appreciate you spreading the word about the podcast. I know you hear this every podcast we listen to now. The standard mantra that we hear is, you know, wherever you get your podcast, like it, subscribe, give us a good review. And that certainly does help us, so we'll pass that on to you as well. So that'd be great if you could do that. You know, here at CPYU, we are really eager to help people understand the place that God has called the church to have in the world. And we also call out where times when we miss that, and it seems like the world really gets in the church. And certainly, one of the ways this is happening in terms of trends, and it's not anything new, it's been happening for quite some time, but it seems more now it's out in the open and even celebrated, is moving outside of God's order and design for matters of sexuality, marriage, and gender. And so today we're going to have a conversation about this. Our friend Dr. David Ayers, who's at Grove City College and a professor of sociology there, has a new book that's being released, and the book is titled Sex and the Single Evangelical. And I know that's a title that's going to get a lot of attention, David, but you've studied this for quite some time. You engaged in some fairly, I mean, I've read the book. It's some fairly deep research where you've dug down into what's happening there, and it really is helpful, and we're going to have a conversation about that. So, David, welcome. I know we've had you on the podcast before, and you've written other books as well that we may hear about, but this is a passion of yours, and I think it's a passion that we should have as well as parents and youth workers and pastors. So if you would, David, go ahead and just give us a little bit of an introduction to the book, and I'm going to prompt you here and say, in the actual introduction to the book, the printed introduction to the book, I've had a chance to read it, although it's not out yet. In the introduction to the book, you really kind of come clean. You tell a story and just talk about how your perspective has changed on some of these things. So that would be great to hear if you'd be willing to share that.
Sure. Well, I really appreciate you having me on today. And it is a passion of mine. And I think that many Christians out there, you know, whether it's in your profession or in mine, when they find us focusing on issues like that, the modern mind naturally wants to lead to judgmental obsession. You know, an old lady with a hair in a bun looking for people to slap with a ruler and tell them how bad they are. Or sometimes, you know, secretly, you know, having these problems ourselves and wanting to take it out on everybody. In other words, all kinds of misperceptions of that. It's like a friend of mine who taught the history of war, and he said, people think that when you teach on war, it's because you like it. And that you have some kind of unhealthy obsession with it. And of course, that's not true. And that's not true for you. And it's certainly not true for me. it's founded in a deep concern for marriage and the family as a fundamental basis of social order and the health of the church. And these other things, including sexual promiscuity and declension and fidelity to a biblical worldview in matters of sex in the body, as indicating a great deal of faithlessness against the Lord and undermining of our witness and bringing upon themselves terrible consequences. So ultimately, although we can err in the side of censoriousness and judgment, just like anybody else can, and we certainly have our own failings and weaknesses that we, you know, constantly have to reflect on as we cope with this stuff, we realize that it's really out of love for God and for his church and a desire for glory and the extension of the kingdom. And I hate seeing people destroy themselves. It breaks my heart. And, you know, so the story you mentioned, you know, I came to Jesus Christ out of the hippie movement in the mid-1970s, Jesus Revolution or Jesus Movement. And almost everyone in my church had a past, you know. You know, there was a few people that grew up Christian and everything, but most of us came in from the outside with a lot of baggage, a lot of wreckage, a lot of regrets. And that was the world that I lived in for a number of years. And so to me, it was really pretty simple. You know, you read the Bible, you incorporate the Bible, you pray, you plug into a God-honoring church, and you begin letting God really deal with these aspects of your life. You fall down, you get up, you're, you know, this kind of thing, but you take it very seriously. And when I entered the world of Christian higher education in 1986, it was in some ways my first step outside of that world, because between graduate school and the church we were involved in, I was still very much in that world. And so I found myself in broader evangelicalism, I guess you could say. And what I was shocked by was, as I increasingly, you know, found out what was going on, but also people's blasé attitudes about it, you know. So the rubber really hit the road when I was involved in teaching a research methodology class, and most of my students were young women, probably about 2 to 1, and we visited a pro-life pregnancy center that was about 2 miles from the school.
Now, this is at a Christian college, correct?
This is at a Christian college that was essentially, at least at that time, fundamentalist. I mean, you not only had to sign a statement of faith and give them your opinion on rapture and tribulation, but they made you sign a behavioral statement that had only recently stopped incorporating going to films, and still, at the time I started there, you couldn't even play cards, okay? So this was a very strict Christian school in which every single student had signed a statement saying that they were a born-again Christian committed to living according to the teachings of the Bible, believing in the inerrant Bible, and literally agreeing not to drink, not to smoke, not to play cards. By the way, it's one of the nice things about being a Presbyterian is you kind of leave some of that stuff in the rearview mirror. In moderation, as we know. Okay, but anyway.
That's true.
So we did a tour of this pro-life pregnancy clinic, and as we were leaving, and I was known among the faculty as being very outspoken on pro-life matters, you know, pro-life issues and so forth. The director of the clinic asked if she could talk to me privately for a minute or two and pulled me aside out of the group. And she said, "I just want you to know, we're seeing a lot of girls from your school. And a lot of them are getting abortions. We know because we follow up on them. So, you know, a number of them end up getting abortions anyway after they come and see us. But you have a serious pregnancy problem at your school." So, in the methodology class, being young and stupid, I just decided to use standardized questions and survey the student population on their sexual practices and beliefs. And all done, you know, professionally. And I wanted to get a gauge on how serious the problem was. Now, I knew there was a problem, but I wasn't really expecting, you know, what I found. So the bottom line is back then when you were doing statistical analysis using SPSS, you sent your, you the results you requested went to a batch printer separate from your computer in another room. Everything came out on these little green and white sheets, you know. And so you had to run the analysis, check it. And you just did that over and over again, very tedious process. Well, to simplify the process, when we had reached the analysis stage, I assigned a student to the batch printer room.
Now, can I interrupt? I just want to clarify. The questioning was done anonymously, correct? So you're...
Oh, everything was anonymous. Yeah, and very carefully done. Yeah. In other words, there was nothing in the survey we could even use to connect anybody to the results. Like, I couldn't assemble that you were a white woman, 19 years old, from Schenectady, you know, and was a professing Baptist, you know. In other words, we made sure that you couldn't even drill down to get that information. So we were getting not only about as honest data as we could, but we were protecting our subjects. And of course, we're ethically bound to do that. But so in retrospect, obviously something I shouldn't have done, you know, it just didn't occur to me. But to run, you know, back and forth through the building between the computers and the batch printer, pretty difficult job. And none of the students were really able to do the programming, because back then SPSS really required a kind of a programming to get your results. So I was with some students at the computer, and we hadn't heard from the student in the printer room for quite some time. So I decided to go to the printer room and find out what was wrong. And when I went into the printer room, she was sitting in front of the printer sobbing. And I said, you know, what's wrong? And she said, have you seen these results? I said, no. She said, they're really, really bad. I said, well, what do you think we should do about that? She said, can we just forget it? Can we just bury this? I said, you know, as social scientists, you know, we can't do that. You know, we have to face reality. And so I talked it through with her, comforted her, and we dealt with it. And I ultimately ended up sharing the results with our board of trustees. Now, and by the way, I didn't publish them or disseminate them or do anything like that. I mean, I realized that this was a landmine that I had stepped in accidentally. But the bottom line is what we found is that most of the students at the college arrived as virgins and left as sexually experienced people, period. And I also knew that if that's how many were admitting to it, the real numbers are worse, because people, the way I put it with students is, if you're asking embarrassing questions, people always lie down, they don't lie up. It's an easy way to remember it, right? The number's always worse than what you think, because that's the direction it's going to be. Even when it's an anonymous, we all know that there's certain things, if you ask a person on an anonymous survey, they're going to say no if the answer is yes. It's just human nature. I don't really judge people for it. Anyway, so shortly after that, I left that college and started at a college in Dallas, Texas. And I was working in my home office one day, and my wife said, I have a letter here from one of your former students. You know, I said, oh, that's great. So she brings it into my office and I open it up. And I will honestly say that it brought tears to my eyes, and it still does sometimes when I think about it. She said, you may not remember me, and I did, but I was a student that was crying in the printer room. You didn't know it at the time, but I had discovered that I was pregnant. And at the time, and of course, that's why she was sobbing. She said, I decided to keep my baby because of you. And as I write this letter, my baby is in my lap and she's alive because of you. You are the only one that was willing to talk about this stuff. and it blew me away. And I think, first of all, that confirmed in my mind how important this is and how important it is to take the flak and deal with it compassionately, but as honestly as possible. Because the problem has gotten far worse since then. And for example, this young lady and many of the other young people at the school didn't think it was okay. They just did it, right? But now they think it's okay. And they're doing worse things now, far worse things to themselves and to other people. Things that are actually far more physically dangerous even than having intercourse and having babies.
Yeah.
But the fact is that people need this. They may not like it, just like she didn't like it, but they do need it. I need it. My children need it. They need us to be honest about ourselves and about the world we live in and about the church, and to compassionately deal with what is honestly right in front of us and not pretend that things are different than they truly are.
Yeah. There's so many questions I want to ask you, and that is a powerful, powerful story. I almost don't know how to follow up after that, you know, and to me, that's just a great moment where God's Spirit was using you unknowingly in the life of that young person. So there's that aspect of just speaking truth and pushing into truth and being consistent with that. And knowing that being faithful and obedient to the biblical narrative, to the, you know, unfolding story of Scripture is just leaves a mark on people without us knowing it. You've said something else there. You've alluded to this a few times. You even write this in your introduction in one way or another, that we are all broken people. And I know, you know, that you lean into the narrative of creation, fall, redemption, and restoration, and that brokenness that we all experience extends to our sexuality. We're all sexually broken, so there's no denying that. I think we need to reckon with that, and that goes back to what you said about we're not talking about it. And for her to say you're the first person who's talked to me about this, you know, man, there's so much in there. And what I want to do is I want to follow up after we take a break, and I want to get into... You know, you're telling us, you know, this hasn't changed in the sense that, you know, we're still dealing with it, but it's much worse. It's much different, you know, and even in the way that young people are acting out. You know, this was obviously rooted in the sexual revolution, which you and I were roughly the same age. You know, we grew up in that in the 1960s. That shaped or maybe misshaped us in some powerful ways. And, you know, as you say, we all have a past and things to reckon with. But, you know, that sexual revolution, I mean, that was just recently seeded then and starting to take root and grow. And now we're seeing the tree of that, you know, really flower and bear fruit, ugly fruit, as it were. But I want to talk about how all that's changed when we come back from the break and hear specifically about what you've learned. Because just as that girl sat there and looked at that printout and said, this is bad. Can we just forget this? Can we bury this? You know, we have to look at how bad it actually is or what the actual facts are and then not bury it but reckon with it. So we're going to look at the facts. We come back. If you're just joining us, we're talking to Dr. David Ayers, who's a professor of sociology at Grove City College in Grove City, Pennsylvania, a school that so many of us have come to know and love for its deep Christian rootedness and what it's teaching students in the realm of Christian higher education, and certainly, you know, this is part of the fruit of that, what's happening at Grove City with the good research. So we'll hear about this when we come back. Stick with us. We'll be right back. Hey, youth workers, I want to let you know about a podcast resource we've recently launched here at CPYU that's just for you. Our brand new The Word in Youth Ministry podcast is a podcast by youth workers and for youth workers that will help you build and improve your ability to teach the Bible and theology to your students. There is not a more important discipleship task than correctly teaching the truths of God's Word to the kids we've been called to lead. We want them to hear the biblical narrative over and above the constant 24/7 noise of the cultural narrative. So check out the Word in Youth Ministry podcast. You can find it at cpyu.org or wherever you get your podcasts. Well, we're having a fascinating and eye-opening and I believe a very helpful conversation with Dr. David Ayers at Grove City College, professor of sociology, who has a new book coming out shortly. It's published by Lexham Press. It's called Sex and the Single Evangelical. This grew out of some pretty eye-opening research that David has conducted. And David, would you share, just give us a flyover of some of the most helpful data, maybe some surprising data, data you think we as parents, as grandparents, as youth workers, as pastors, as educators, the data that we need to hear. I think that the data can really help us understand the situation and then motivate us to respond properly.
Sure. Well, what I'll do is I'll cherry pick a few things from my new book, and remembering, of course, that it's not all data. But
right.
So first of all, and let's remember, too, that the way these surveys I use measure evangelicals is based on their church membership and denominational commitment. They're not asking people to self-identify as evangelicals, but if they're attending a Southern Baptist church, you know, it's called the RELTRAD way of measuring it. It's not perfect, but it's I think the best that we have, and it's a standard. So, for example, among and I'll focus on young people, among those 18 to 29 who call themselves evangelicals in the most recent decade of the General Social Survey, only 40% of evangelicals said that sex outside of marriage was always or almost always wrong. And 60% said it's only wrong sometimes or it's not wrong at all. So there's one piece of data. The 35% say that cohabitation is acceptable even if there are no plans whatsoever for the couple to marry. And by the way, and I deal with this in a separate article, which appeared recently, a few months ago in Christianity Today. But most young evangelical people are actually planning on or open to cohabiting. It's only a small minority who say, no, I will never cohabit before marriage. But this is like no plans to marry. Over one out of three evangelicals say, fine, not a problem.
Interject here while you're looking. I want to mention, you know, because you mentioned that Christianity Today article, for those who maybe are new to the podcast, we will list, Chris Wagner here will provide links to all of the resources that David is mentioning today, anything he's mentioned already and anything he will mention. So if you go to our homepage, cpyu.org, and look for the particular episode of this podcast and scroll down under the player, you will see links to these things. And I am familiar with that article you wrote. It's excellent.
Okay. Yeah. And so, for example, among 15 to 17-year-olds, those young people in your youth groups and the churches, only one out of five say they will definitely not live with somebody in the future. And only 3 out of 10 of those 18 to 22 say the same thing. It all gets a little bit better when you look at people who are going to church every week. But even then, the reality is often shocking. So how many sex partners have you had in your lifetime? We look at 18, but by the time they're 18 to 22 years old. Among evangelical Protestants, only 3 out of 10 have not had sex with somebody by the time they're 18 to 22 years old. And a slightly more than 3 out of 10 evangelical Protestants have had 3 or more sex partners by the time they're 18 to 22 years old. This is based on the National Survey of Family Growth for 2019, which is a gold standard, huge survey put out by the Center for Disease Control. And by the way, the numbers that I just gave you are for males. For females, by the way, 37% of evangelical females have had three or more sex partners by the time they are 18 to 22 years old. The what I also found was that engaging in, shall we say, alternative forms of sex is increasingly popular among evangelical young people. And I won't give you the percentages on all of these, and it's distasteful to deal with this in too much detail. Those details are in the book, but oral sex is unbelievably common. And
you know, but let me interrupt you there, because and I know I've read about that, and you know, a lot of your analysis here will go back, you know, historically. I know as a sociologist and even an anthropologist trained, you understand these things. But where, like, parents today, I hear parents say, like, where are my kids learning this? You know, do you have any insights on that? I mean, I have opinions related to, you know, obviously pornography, and then that starts to spread through the peer group, and peer influence is strong. You know, would you agree with that? I mean, as you've watched this unfold?
Yeah, well, and it's all, in fact, the funny thing is that a lot of our young people find it odd that the adults in their world are ignorant of this or afraid to talk about how big of an issue it is because it's so well known to them. But just to give an example, there was a Rolling Stone, there's a Rolling Stone song, right? And I'm just trying to remember it, you know, I kind of like playing music. And so the other night I looked it up on the internet. Baby used to stay out all night long. You know, I can't remember the name of the song. Oh, I used to love her, but it's all over now, right? So I thought, oh, I'm just going to look up that song. And my search engine is set to moderate control, which is the default setting, right? In other words, it's supposed to be porn blocking. And boom, there it was. And popping into the thumbnails, just from me putting the title of a 1965 Rolling Stone song on the internet and just trying to check the lyrics and remind myself what it sounded like. That was it. Those images included immediately, obviously, people getting ready to engage in oral sex.
Yeah.
Now, there was not a single curse word, reference to sex, nothing in the title of that song. It's just, because I used to love her, but it's all over now. I mean, how innocuous can you get?
Yeah. Hey, you know.
So they're pushing it at you all the time.
Yeah. And it's funny because we're the same age, all right? We're both 65. We're both music lovers. When I'm out, you know, outside, or I'm walking, I will often listen to podcasts. And when the podcast ends, rather than start a new podcast, I'll go to the music and I'll start putting on, you know, playlists of old music that I listened to in the 70s and 80s and, you know, even back to the 60s and so on. And now as an adult who maybe is more tuned into lyrical messages as opposed to just the sound of the music, which I love, you know, the other day, I mean, this was just 2 days ago, the song Take Me Home Tonight by Eddie Money came on, and I really listened carefully to that kind of that lusty, you know, I mean, it's just this, it ties into everything you're talking about, and yet there's nothing lyrically or in the title that would clue you in, you know, with the word sex or anything like that, that this is what you're about, but you're discriminating. It's clear. You know, I encounter this all the time. I mean, it's so rooted in the fabric of, you know, the worldview that we were taught and listening to and even singing along to. Yeah.
Yeah, absolutely. You know, the funny thing is that the people in the 50s and 60s that were warning about where this might go, that folks like you and I probably wrote off as ignorant fuddy-duddies, you know, we have to admit at this point that they were right. But I don't even think that Elvis and people like that thought it was going to go this far. You know, they were playing on the edges of this stuff. But, you know, that was the beginning of the sexual revolution, and we've never really recovered from that.
Yeah. Yeah.
So, yeah, 18 to 22-year-old female evangelicals, two-thirds of them indicate that they've engaged in some form of oral sex. And probably the most damaging one is anal, which is unbelievably dangerous. And for 18 to 22 year old females who consider themselves evangelicals, we're pushing at 1 out of 4.
Yeah.
And I try not to spend too much time on that. And partly, I don't want people getting desensitized to this stuff. At the same time, that is so dangerous from a medical standpoint. That we just saw, and I don't know if you all saw this, but did you all saw the video of the woman at a school board meeting who found out that they were pushing that particular form of deviant sexuality in a textbook for kids at a junior high school. And when she started reading the passage from the book that their children were reading, they turned her microphone off. But then the school board admitted as a problem that maybe they need to consider that book. Now, Teen Vogue had a whole issue thematically focused on helping young people to discover the joys of anal sex. Now, what kind of culture have we created?
Yeah.
And how do you even begin? You know, if a youth pastor said to me, I don't even know how to talk to kids about this stuff, I'd say, well, that's your job. You're gonna have to figure this one out. But I will say this, it's deadly.
Yeah.
It's crazy.
Yeah.
And it's degrading. So,
you know,
find a way.
Yeah,
you know,
and
find a way.
Let me offer a suggestion on how to answer that question. And this is not a suggestion to you. It's to those who are listening, because, you know, you've sort of identified in the Christian church, the evangelical church, the fundamental church, more specifically, over the course of time, that it was always like borders and boundaries set up. Don't do this. Don't do that. Don't do this. Don't do that. And nobody ever explained what those borders and boundaries were there for. Like, they didn't know why, you know, why has that fence been erected, so to speak? And so kids were hearing that don't do this, don't do that, which of course shuts everybody down, and they don't talk about it, and they do it in secret when they do this and they do that. But I think what people have learned over the years is there's a beautiful story about God's wonderful gift of sexuality when we go back to Genesis 1 and 2. And we can start, we've said this here at CPYU, let's start with what God is for, his good and grand design, and have those conversations over and over again. Now, the beauty of your book, and you said just a few minutes ago, it's not all data, and I'm glad you said that, because the opening chapter is titled Sex and Marriage, United in God's Perfect Design. And that gives us, you know, that chapter really gives us a clear theology of sexuality that, you know, if people are, you know, just wondering, like, what do I say? Where do I start? And parents, we've learned, most of them have no clue how to talk about this. It's uncomfortable because, A, it's a different culture, but B, their parents never taught them. Their parents never had these conversations. Maybe they got a book, you know, that was it. And
right.
Done
right.
Over with. So you're making a compelling case here for better efforts, and I love that first chapter in the book. I wanted to throw that in because that's one of the great benefits of the book.
Well, it's interesting too, because my editor told me after reading, you know, looking through the manuscript, he said, I had doubts about starting the book that way, because of course you want to grab people's attention, right? But he said, once I saw that, I realized that that was the right way to go. Namely, we're going to look at reality from God's mountain and all the glories and wonders and good things that he has for his people, and how every rule or commandment is given to us in love, ordered by the God who created the universe and knows the laws that hold it together. And built it for us. And then to proceed into the declension of the culture and the muck and the mire of the data, and then return to how do we get back onto this mountain? And I think it's still a danger, you know, in some ways, I guess what the editor was saying, that somebody would pick up the book and see that and go, oh, I thought I was going to get a lot of hardcore reality, a lot of punchy details, a lot of, no, and by the way, those details should make you sad. They should make you want to see this change, because what's expressed in the first chapter is God's heart for us and his heart for our children, right down to my 2-year-old and 3-year-old grandchildren, what he wants for them. And and what he wants us to desire passionately that they have. And that's why too, we need to get away from, and I could talk about that when we get into the practical suggestions, but we need to get away from a rule-based understanding of this stuff.
Yeah.
Because God said so, you know, that kind of thing.
Yeah. Are you teaching a intro to sociology class, a basic sociology class that's required for all students at Grove City? Am I mistaken on that?
I'm teaching an intro class that meets one of the requirements, but there's other ways to meet it.
Yeah. So in that class, do you broach this research? Do you broach this topic at all with your students? I'm just out of curiosity. Have you had these conversations with your students there? And I'm not asking about the practices of Grove City College students specifically. I'm asking about how, you know, you're engaging these conversations with young people in this 18 to 22 year old, you know, age segment who are there on the campus at Grove City, you know, a solid Christian institution of higher education. I'm just asking, you know, how those conversations go there and the curiosity, because I know you're talking about these things differently now than maybe you did in the past. And how do students receive that?
Well, where I get into it in real detail is in my Family as a Social Institution class, which is required for the Family Studies minor. So we get a lot of students in there. Many of them are ministry minded. Many of them are, by the way, our students in our Biblical and Religious Studies program as well. It's really interesting. First of all, none of them are actually shocked by the reality. Again, I think they're more shocked that we're shocked. Like, of course, you know, but the other thing is, and this is increasing over time, and this isn't a knock on Grove City College by any stretch of the imagination. I guarantee you it's as bad or worse at any Christian college in this country. I am getting more and more pushback because of the morals that I hold from people who claim to be Christians and just have a more enlightened understanding of what the Bible teaches. And it particularly hits the fan if I deal with anything remotely dealing with the LGBT. Yeah. But then, of course, if you're not going to be okay with, let's say, cohabitation, then they kind of know already where you're going to go with the LGBT. And so when I do these anonymous course evaluations, every time I teach that family class, I get more students who say that in those areas of the class, they were angry at what I had to say because I'm so obviously judgmental. And yet anybody who reads my book or talks to me, and it's not because I'm perfect, I'm just saying, people don't really walk away going, oh, what a judgmental, terrible person this guy is. I mean, the world that I came out of into Christianity is one in which I'm disgusted with the life that I lived before I knew the Lord. I have no basis whatsoever. And even the things I've struggled with, as all of us have since I've been a believer, or seen very fine people struggling with. But nevertheless, the mere fact of holding the quote wrong views. And it's because but when I look at these tables in the text, I go, well, of course that's the case. If only 4 out of 10 of the students in my classes, and it's probably a better average at Grove City College, but if only 4 out of 10 of the students in my classes think that any sex outside of marriage is wrong. And if the majority of them think, you know, that there's no living together outside of marriage is not a problem, then how are they going to react when I start talking about those things? It's usually not, well, you know, I want to reconsider this. I want to think about it. I want to look at the scriptures together. It's really more, how dare this person say that? Because we're also in a sensitivity culture where your words and my words are judged by whether or not they fit people's pre-existing sensibilities. As Carl Truman points out very well in his recent book, they view my morality and your morality not as God's reflecting the scriptures. They view it as our personal tastes and preferences. And they view it as, this means you hate me, or you're trying to erase me,
yeah,
or you're not accepting me as a human being. And I thank God that when I became a believer, it wasn't that way. It was no question that the believers reaching out to me with the gospel were accepting me as I was, as a human being. However, they were not accepting my sin. as something that should be an ongoing part of my life. And but that distinction is lost on people now, I think, increasingly on young people.
Yeah.
And it's just more challenging to talk about it than ever. And if I'm facing challenges at Grove City College, I can only imagine what the youth pastors are facing. And by the way, it's not necessarily just the students. It's oftentimes the parents as well.
Yeah. You know, I want to say something to that, and that is that it is very easy when you get this kind of pushback, when the cultural narrative has been accepted so widely, and it is so pervasive, and it's so convincing, and young people can't imagine, and even old people, as you just said, can't imagine thinking otherwise. And for anyone who does think otherwise, you're judgmental. Now the temptation is for me as a youth worker, for me as a parent who wants to be engaged in a relationship with a young person, is to start to waffle on the truth or start to loosen up, and as a way to maintain that good relationship. And I just read the other day some great words from J.I. Packer. Some commentary on Jesus talking about false teachers, and Packer was unpacking what the false teachers, you know, what is a false teacher? And I wish I had it in front of me, because he was describing a false teacher as someone who, you know, is trying to benefit in a selfish way from not telling the whole truth, perhaps. And I, what caught me in that, I sat on that for a while, because it helped me understand that, you know, what he's describing is maybe a youth worker has so many kids who are leaning into the cultural narrative on sexuality or homosexuality or gender issues that I don't want to alienate them, because alienating them would, you know, would be harmful to our relationship and harmful to me. So now I'll start to waffle on the truth, because the other benefit is that I get to maintain my relationship and teach these kids. But the reality is, now I think this sounds harsh, but I truly believe that when we do that, Packer's really helped me see that, you know, you have stepped very quickly into the realm of being a false teacher. And we often say here, I mean, you know this, that a half-truth is far more dangerous than a complete lie. And we have just a preponderance of that in the church. So, yeah, so we need to take a break. Now, when we come back, I want to start to get really practical, because, you know, we just with what we just said, we're asking youth workers and parents to, you know, sort of buckle up and have a spine, know the truth, teach the truth. But let's talk a little bit more about how to do that, what truths we need to teach, what your research has shown us about that. So we'll be back in just a minute to talk more with Dr. David Ayers. Tens of thousands of kids have been trained by their parents and youth workers to think Christianly about music and media with our How to Use Your Head to Guard Your Heart 3D Guide to Making Wise Media Choices. This easy-to-use teaching tool needs to be in your youth ministry toolbox if you desire to teach your students to integrate their faith into all of life. Jesus calls us to follow Him, and that includes following Him into the 6 to 9 hours a day of screen time that shape and mold the beliefs and behaviors of our kids. To learn more about our 3D Media Evaluation Guide and to order a copy for every member of your youth group, go to our website at cpyu.org. Teach your kids to engage with media to the glory of God. So, David, earlier on in our conversation, you said something, four words that I wrote down in quotation marks. You said, not talking about it, which happens to be a big part of the issue about why we've gone trending in the wrong direction rather than in a more godly, God-honoring, God-glorifying direction on matters of sexuality and our understanding of marriage and our practices. Because we haven't talked about it, maybe we shouldn't be surprised that people are, you know, not engaging with sexuality and marriage issues the way they should be done, because we've not framed that for people. And so we want to talk about how to talk about it, specifically stylistically. You know, what recommendations would you make? And I know we have parents listening, we have youth workers listening, pastors, counselors, all sorts of folks, And I would guess that none of us are at a point where we're going, okay, I'm ready to walk in the room and talk about this with great confidence. So I'd love to hear a little bit of some practical responses here to what you've learned in terms of stylistically how to talk about this and even some of the more concrete factors, things we should bring up. So go for it.
Well, sure. In terms of stylistically, been putting together a message for a church that I'm going to be conducting some workshops on this in about sometime in mid-November. They asked me to finish my time at their church with a sermon, and I said, what I want to do in a sermon is to lay out how we should address these things. How do we speak the truth in love without neglecting either side of that equation? And what I've developed, and it's basically done at this point, is I just decided to do a deep dive into Jesus' interaction with what I call the three unnamed sinful women. The woman caught in adultery, which I know the controversy about the passage, but it happened, and most commentators agree that it did. The woman, probably a prostitute that was washing Jesus' feet with her hair, which means she was broken and sobbing uncontrollably in front of a table full of Pharisees. And the Samaritan woman at the well. And looking at the quality of Jesus's interaction with those women. And also his asides or side dealings with the Pharisees or the straight-laced people during that time. Because, and I came up with essentially nine lessons, and I'm sure there's many more, but, you know, without recounting all of them, the bottom line is that he didn't pound people into the dust. He didn't decide, as long as we're dealing with one sin, let's deal with your other 100. You know, let me have you leaving this room crippled and wounded. When people got offended at him and got in his face and were even outrageous, you know, so, for example, the woman caught in adultery, they were literally trying to get him to go along with an illegal execution while letting the guy involved in that adulterous relationship go scot-free. The whole thing was ludicrous. It was outlandish. And yet, he uses people's first names. He talks to them gently. He asks questions, and he waits for them to answer. He responds to the answers that they give. He is personal. Courageous, loving, but he also knows where he wants to go. And he doesn't try to throw in everything but the kitchen sink while he's at it. You know, it's really surprising, you know, that he didn't give him a laundry list, but said things like, go and sin no more. Your sins are forgiven you. Don't sin anymore, lest worse things befall you, right? He didn't, you know, we are waffling, we are going liberal, or we are going in the other direction and just sometimes just getting plain mean. Partly out of fear. Partly out of fear of what's happening to us culturally. Fear that we're going to lose our freedoms. Fear that we're going to lose our kids. You know, fear that our kids are going to suddenly identify as transgender. And that everybody's going to back them. And that's just being handled in all kinds of ways. And yet, to carry the whole truth with humility and integrity and to deal with people face to face and to really, when you're talking to that person or these people, you are the most important person in the room. You know, the Messiah was incredibly interested in these people. He focused on them and let them speak. And, you know, more speaking, more listening and less speaking is a pretty good way to do it. Now, I know that can become a dodge, right, to keep us from saying the wrong things. But, you know, until you know what's on their mind and they're free to tell you what's on their mind, you can't really address the problems. And Jesus, of course, knew what was on their minds already, but he still would ask the question and let them express it. He also oftentimes gave them room to reach a conclusion on their own and then affirmed it. He didn't always just tell them what to think. And so with the woman caught in adultery, for example, with the crowd, he said, you know, let the one who's without sin cast the first stone. And then they were all accused by their own consciousness, starting with the oldest, which is interesting, right? Because you and I are old enough that we've blown it so many times that we're probably more acutely aware of the adultery in our own hearts than maybe some of those young men were. But notice, starting with the oldest, they put down their stones and walked away. So we can be, and I know the word is way overused, but using it correctly, we can be very winsome without being gutless. And so I think stylistically, we cannot do better than to study Jesus's modes of interaction and ask, you know, how well does the way I'm handling this line up with how he would have handled the same situation? Not in some pie in the sky, what would Jesus do way, but what do the scriptures tell us about how he related to people? I think that that's just incredibly important.
Let me respond to that, because I love what you're saying, and it's made me think about over the last few years, as I have engaged with youth workers and said, hey, what are you doing to speak to realities about sexuality and gender? And they'll oftentimes respond and say, well, those are hard, difficult conversations to have. We're not going down that road because, and this is what they say, we just want to bring kids to Jesus. And, you know, that like that discounts. I mean, basically, you're being silent and on these matters, and you're saying you want to bring them to Jesus, but then you're making Jesus silent as well, because as you point out, you know, there's tremendous insights in terms of style and content, in terms of, you know, our Savior modeling for us how to engage these with grace and truth, which I loved what you said there, without neglecting either side. And we can't silence the Jesus that we quote unquote, using the words of many of the people I've talked to, the Jesus we brought them to. And so I love that the way that you say this. It's just a thought that you sparked for me.
Well, you know, people say that verse has become so important to me, and then fleshing it out in my own life, speaking the truth in love. You can't do one without the other. If you're not speaking the truth, you're not loving them. And if you're speaking the truth, and that truth does not include the love that God has for them, and the forgiveness and the cleansing that's available for them, and the restoration and the sanctification that's being freely offered to them, you're not really speaking the truth. You can't speak the truth without love. If you do, it's not really the truth. And you can't be loving without truth. If you do, it's really not loving. So sometimes when we talk about doing both, or even viewing them as complementary, they're not just complementary, although they are mutually required. You cannot do one truly without doing the other. It's like, and I know what people mean, but when they talk about loveless orthodoxy, if it's loveless, it ain't orthodoxy. Because orthodoxy includes love. Orthodoxy includes 1 Corinthians 13. Orthodoxy includes the good shepherd who lays down his life for his sheep, who neglects the 99 in order to bring back the one who is lost, who laid down his life for his friends. And so there is no such thing as loveless orthodoxy, really, although I know what people mean by it. If it's loveless, it's not orthodoxy. And right now, I think the bigger problem in the church is the truthless love. They're not bringing people to Jesus. They're bringing people to a Jesus that Elton John would describe as being real, you know, just a cool guy who did nice things for other people and was loving, you know, but would never judge me and my husband. That's not true at all.
Yeah.
That's not the Jesus in the Bible.
Yeah, it's interesting. Now, you're the first person who, in describing that, used Elton John as an example. You know, we've talked about the Oprah test. You know, if Oprah says this is right on and this is right, that means we run, right? So I hear what you're saying. And again, this is another example of how compelling and pervasive and convincing, you know, widespread the, I mean, I could use all sorts of words here, but the cultural narrative is, and how when our kids are swimming in this soup, it just shapes or misshapes or forms, or we would more accurately say deforms them in terms of, you know, moving towards what it means to be truly human and what it means to flourish as a human being. So I love this. This is great. Let me ask you, and of course we want to recommend the book again. I mean, obviously we're going to start there, Sex and the Single Evangelical. It's published by Lexham Press. Again, we will, once that link's available, we're going to include that, because it is forthcoming, and we do know publishers are a little backlogged right now just because of COVID and all the work-related issues. You know, they don't have enough workers to even publish books, but we're excited. This one is coming out, and just check on our podcast player. Chris Wagner will put that link there, and I know that you can do a Google search as well. By the way, David, if you're just listening, David Ayers, you know how to spell David, D-A-V-I-D. Ayers is A-Y-E-R-S, so if you're going to Google David's name, you never know what's going to come up, but I'm sure there's some great, great content that folks will be able to find with that. I want to ask you as well, David, any other resources as we close this out, any other that you would mention that would be helpful to folks as they endeavor to really balance truth and love and teach God's good design for sexuality?
Well, can self-promote just for a second, but I've got a Life of the Mind lecture series. Each lecture is 25 minutes long, and Grove City College will begin releasing those on October 6th, one a week. Now there, it basically takes a lot of what Truman deals with in his book and applies it to what's happening to marriage and family and sexuality. Basically the triumph of the therapeutic and expressive individualism and defining our own reality. So some people might find that helpful and maybe less onerous than a lot of the written stuff. Mark Regnerus is golden. He is a sociologist that I respect enormously. He has a great deal of courage, and he's written numerous books on this, including on religion and sexuality and sex among religious people. I think Mark is a professing Catholic, a conservative one, by the way, at University of Texas, Austin, which is one of the top sociology programs in the world. He's taken a lot of flack for stances that he's taken. His book, Cheap Sex, I just cannot recommend a book more in terms of understanding how widespread sexual promiscuity and the availability of sex is basically destroying marriage and how prevalent it really is. But he's always taken great pains to get into and comparing religious youth with everybody else. And so it's masterful. If you can key into the Institute for Family Studies, I've written a lot for them. But they present some of the best research in the world in short form on areas having to do with sex in the family. Top scholars that write for them, very both opinion but also research-driven articles, typically very accessible. If you can get that on your if you can get that on your subscription list, you know, then every week they'll send you a link to their latest sets. The amount of material in there that's helpful is just enormous. If anybody out there hasn't read it, you need to read Christian Smith's book about moral therapeutic deism.
Soul searching.
Moral therapeutic deism is still, and I deal with it in my latest book, it's still one of the best summaries of the wrong ways that religious people think about God and have made themselves bigger than God, and have basically made God the cool God of, and I mentioned Elton John because he brought up Jesus in an interview. The cool God, the cool Jesus of Elton John is the moral therapeutic deist Jesus, and that is now the majority view in the church. There's also, I think it's, I'm gonna get this wrong, and I'm sorry if I do, but J- George Barna is now leading a research institute, and it's housed, I think, at Arizona Christian University. And I shouldn't plug another university, but Arizona Christian University is doing some amazing things. And one of my son-in-law's brother is currently attending there and apparently says it's just an amazing place. But George Barna, as you know, is a marketing executive researcher who's in their barna.org. Is a great resource for all these things. But Arizona Christian has been doing these worldview survey studies that are each iteration of them is very well publicized and fleshed out. But they continue, it's Christian Worldview Institute or Institute for Christian Worldview or something like that at Arizona Christian University. And you won't have any trouble finding it.
Yeah, we'll link to that mailing list. We'll link to that.
Get on that mailing list, because in terms of tracking trends going on in the church, including trends related to worldview, theology, religious practice, and sex and marriage, what they're doing is just incredible. It's disturbing, but it's incredible. And they're doing this now. The first iteration was released like every couple weeks. It was a huge study, part of the survey that was released. And now they're doing it. They're updating it every year. And I just cannot recommend it enough.
Yeah.
I think that the barna.org and even getting a paid, having your church pay for a paid subscription to barna.org that staff at your church can access is just incredible. Their study on pornography, which I deal with a great deal in my book, is absolutely devastating. It's designed to facilitate positive action.
Yeah.
The data that they pulled together on pornography use among pastors, it was just mind blowing. But they went beyond that. They interviewed pastors and said, you know, how are you experiencing this? Why is this happening? Why are you afraid to talk to your elders about this? You know, what would help you to deal with this? You know, that kind of stuff. But also with the kids. And so. I think the thing I like about these sources is that you're getting really sound stuff in digestible bite-sized chunks that are rooted in facts and motivated by the desire to help the church do better.
Yeah, and let me say something to youth workers and pastors who are listening. You know, David just went through a bunch of resources, and you make, man, how am I going to use that? I mean, obviously, I think we need to dig into this stuff to keep us informed, because if we don't know what's happening, we're not going to respond to the realities that are out there. But in addition, you know, as he mentioned, digestible nuggets, you know, we can even further break those down and hand them on in very bite-sized chunks through texts and emails and posts on our website or parent meetings. We have to get this stuff in the hands of parents, because parents, I mean, what a job, you know. David's a grandparent like I am, and I know this ramps it up for us now that we see our grandkids growing up in this particular, you know, social environment and how they're being catechized by the cultural narrative. And man, give us, as grandparents as well, give us what we need to know. Youth workers, be a hero to us and give us what we need to know to answer this. I'm going to throw one more thing in, and I've been thinking about it the whole time you've been talking, because we just posted on the day that we're here recording this, you know, we do these little 3D reviews of popular music. And I know you and I, David, we're of the same vintage. And we went back, you know, we both mentioned songs from the 60s and the 70s. And we could have gone on and probably had a series of podcasts on the music and the messages. And we always say here, you know, kind of my street level sociology lesson is to get people to see that youth culture is the soup that our kids swim in, and it serves as a map and a mirror. You know, it's mapping life for our kids, and it mirrors back to us the kinds of things that we need to be addressing and talking about. And so we've tracked with that. And just as of this recording, just a week ago, a little over a week ago at the 2021 MTV Video Music Awards, the video of the year was awarded. Now, this is, please understand this, this is the best, right? This is what we celebrate as the best. So the video of the year, video and song of the year was by Lil Nas X, and the title is Montero, which is his real name, his real first name, so it's autobiographical. And if you haven't seen this, we did post. I can't even recommend to go watch it. That's a dangerous recommendation. I mean, I felt when I first saw this, I was just blown away by what I saw visually, the explicit nature of it, and the dark spirituality, overt spirituality in this. But basically, you know, here's a guy who was raised by a Christian dad who was a gospel singer and fell under, I believe, a lot of the condemnation, David, that you've described in terms of, you know, posture regarding sexuality. And so he's same-sex attracted. He would say he's gay, and he really pushed that under the rug for a long time because of guilt. And now he has just embraced that totally and is propagating that through his music. He's only 22 years old. And in this particular song, it really is a visual metaphor for his release from being, in his words, you know, kind of oppressed because he couldn't live this out, to now embracing it and actually visually choosing to move from what the church's message would be. And I don't think he really gets that clearly because it wasn't communicated to him clearly, but what he perceived the church's message to be, or how he experienced that, moving away from that and actually embracing hell, actually embracing, you know, the message of what the scriptures call the world, the flesh, and the devil, to an ending where he actually snaps the neck of the devil and takes the horns on the devil and puts them on his own head. He's assuming that identity. And there are strong sexual, spiritual messages in there. And when you have, to date, well, I think it's, what is it, Chris, over 350 million views of that video on YouTube. And, I mean, you're not even measuring streams and you know, that sort of thing. But when you have that, coupled with the fact that MTV comes out and says, yes, we're celebrating this, this is the greatest video and message of the year, that is eye-opening and really serves as a motivator. So Chris has put up a downloadable PDF. It's 2 pages, and it goes through our 3D methodology of discover, discern, decide, where we lay out what the worldview is in this and then offer some, you know, scriptural insights into that, giving kids the truth and then certainly how to use this. And yeah, as much as I say don't watch it, I know our kids have. And unfortunately, we're going to have to process this with them because they've probably mindlessly just, you know, assimilated this into who they are. And David, as you talk about, you know, students just believing, mm-hmm. Yeah, this is the way it is. This is what our kids believe. This is the way it is. And this actually teaches them, hey, here's an option to embrace. So,
I believe that correct me if I'm wrong, this is the same person that designed a hot new pair of shoes for Nike.
Yeah.
That are basically Satan shoes.
Yeah.
And that each shoe has a drop of blood built into it.
Yeah, yeah. So it's they did. It's actually, he took a Nike shoe, and Nike and he had some folks, you know, modify it. And Nike has claimed they had nothing to do with this, but he took their shoes and he created the Satan shoe. It's limited edition, 666 pairs. It's got a pentagram on it, and there is what do they call that in the sole? It's like a bubble sole, Chris, or whatnot, filled with like a red liquid. In that red liquid, there is one drop of human blood. And I mean, it's just, yeah, I mean, you'll find this on the internet, and our kids are aware of it. Kids are aware of it. Yeah.
And we've also we have active deconversion proselytization going on. John Piper's own son.
Yeah.
Dedicating a great deal of his time to this. And Josh Harris.
TikTok. Yeah.
And now has a paid workshop, and it's free if you've been damaged by his teaching, where he, over a period of several weeks, walks you out of Christianity and helps you overcome essentially your addiction to conservative religious belief.
Yeah. So as I heard that story, I mean, he put that up as a paid workshop, and now did you just say it's free? I had not heard that.
It's free. So if you write him, I guess the way that I read it is, if you were damaged by his earlier books,
yeah,
he will give it to you for free. Now, my guess is then he's going to follow up on a paid second stage.
Well, he
nevertheless,
he did...
it's like really like religious detox.
Yeah. Now, I don't know what the latest is, but that was what you describe is actually what originally happened. And I think he took so much heat that he backed off of that and pulled it down. So I don't know if it's back up or not, and it's back up totally. It's free. But what you said was absolutely correct. You know, when he put that out. So yeah, this is just where we're going. So David Ayers, thank you so much. I love talking to you. You know, my background undergraduate was sociology and anthropology, and I certainly have not gone as far as you have with my studies in those areas. But I love to read and listen to folks like you. Grove Cities College is blessed to have you. Your students are blessed to have you, and we just want to encourage you to keep on, or if I can steal a phrase from the late '60s, early '70s, keep on keeping on, right?
Right. Or keep on trucking.
Yeah, keep on trucking.
Maybe that's a little bit too
Man, we are dating ourselves now. But you know, those hey, look, I'm telling you, you know what goes around comes around, and all that stuff, you know, it comes back in style. So we can sit silently by and watch as our grandkids grow up and assimilate a lot of those styles. So that's actually quite fun to do. But thank you. God bless you. Again, I'll just mention Chris Wagner is going to post all of these links. And we remind you, if you give us a good review, if you subscribe, if you share this with others, that's so helpful to us as we spread the word about Youth Culture Matters. And we'll talk to you the next time on the next episode of Youth Culture Matters.
Thanks for joining us for Youth Culture Matters, a podcast from the Center for Parent Youth Understanding. If you'd like to learn more about today's youth culture, visit our website at cpyu.org. And if you have any questions, comments, or feedback, email us at podcast@cpyu.org.